I think we're ready to begin, if y'all are ready to begin. You know, it hasn't rained in Mississippi, in Oxford, Mississippi, in what, back in 3 weeks or more?
They claimed it rained 3 weeks ago.
But, of course, now it's raining. We should be fine for our events out in the Grove this afternoon. So, just hope for the best that we don't get a downpour. You'll notice there's another event out in the Grove at the same time. There's a diabetes walk today. So, it's kind of somehow appropriate. Nonetheless, it's my pleasure to introduce Dick Pillsbury. I've known Dick's work for a long while and admired it. And Dick came to our last Southern Foodway Symposium and we all got to know him a bit better. I'll tell you just a little bit about him. He finished his graduate work at Penn State and then moved to West Virginia and then to Atlanta and finally to Charleston, where he currently resides. But it's really, are you right in Charleston?
I'm in Folly Beach.
Yeah, Folly Beach.
I can't afford to live south of Broad.
what Dick is, and you'll realize this by the course of his presentation, he's a cultural geographer. Is that a fair approximation of what you do?
That's fair, yes.
All right. He's explored the geography of food from production in the Atlas of American Agriculture, the American Cornucopia, to retail consumption in the book From Boarding House to Bistro, The American Restaurant Then and Now. And his most recent book is No Foreign Food, The American Diet in Time and Place, which I have copies of two of these out of the three, so I think I'm doing all right. I love, of all of them, I like No Foreign Food the best. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful book and a great piece of scholarship. He's currently working on a book on the regionality of Southern foodways and its future as American regional life rapidly declines. Dick Pillsbury.
When John called me last spring, I was still searching for a title. I think we're going to probably end up with grits, lines, barbecue belts, and some other change beside the other one, probably key lime pie. But my working title at that time was Sliding Towards Nouveau. But nobody could understand what that meant, so I had to add the N from Greasy Greens to Natalie Dupree. Natalie, unfortunately, isn't here to catch that one. But anyway, and then another title that I came up with this morning, as after listening to yesterday, was The Rise and Fall of Southern Cooking from Granny's Biscuits to Southern Living. In any event, what I'm interested in is the regionality of food, and what that means, and how that comes to be. One of the problems that I have talking to people who aren't geographers is that we need to talk just a second about generalization. I live with this woman who believes that everything in the world is unique, and so therefore there are an endless number of things, and they all have to need their own name. We're going to make some gross generalizations today, some very gross generalizations. And what we need to keep in mind is if I asked each of you to write down a recipe for a potato salad, there would be 75 different recipes in this group and at least 10 species of potato salads, but ultimately we would all recognize them as, if we had to describe them, as potato salad. So we're going to make some kind of gross generalizations, and we're going to hope that things don't get too far out of hand. And one of the reasons that we have to make gross generalizations is because of things like this. This was one of the few attempts to talk about barbecue regions that has been done. This appeared in 1982 in an unnamed magazine, who, by the way, provided this. So we can't hold them too much to task. And the problem with this sucker is there's pigs everywhere, and there's cows everywhere, and then there's these strange red things that they never define. But the problem is it's a mess. And I was going to make up my own map, but one of the first things I discovered about barbecue is that it is a mess. And so I ended up that I had to use theirs, which is quite all right. Natalie, you missed it. Sliding towards I got to get this right. Sliding Torch Nouveau, from Greasy Greens to Natalie Dupree. You'll be in bookstores everywhere. It's extremely difficult. What we're going to try to do is to work our way through this and to see if we can get down to some kinds of generalizations. I've been working over the last few months with Stan Woodward in the Southern Stews Project that was written up in our last newsletter out of the McKissick Museum. And being a geographer, I had to make a map. Nothing makes any sense to me until I put it on a map. And so I sat down at the computer last week and started drawing away on what I could do with Brunswick stew. And the oldest claim for Brunswick stew is Jimmy Matthews in 1828 up in Brunswick County. And it turns out that that I've been flying, I saw John come in, thanks to John Edgerton, under some false impressions about that first stew, which was consisted of squirrel and onion, period. All the rest of these vegetables came in much later. And so it was a very simple squirrel stew all it got from Jimmy Matthews was the name. Everything else came later. And in fact, they still make a stew quite similar to that in the next county over, in Lunenburg County, called sheep stew, which is closer to the original Brunswick stew than any others. Now, as a geographer, I'm interested in how this changes, and we see Brunswick stew coming down. It picks up probably in the 1890s, okra and corn and butter beans and potatoes. It gets to South Carolina, and they don't know what Brunswick stew is. They have hash. We'll talk about hash in a little while, but they have hash. Actually, there's multitude of hashes, but they all call it the same thing. And that has to do with South Carolina education system. And then finally, Brunswick stew kind of keeps on zipping on as it goes down around the corner, but unfortunately loses the okra, it loses the butter beans, and pretty soon by the time you get to Alabama, it's an entirely different dish. The only thing that's left is the fact that this is a big stew cooked in a pot and it's got some meat and vegetables in it. And then burgoo is generally presumed to be in some way related to Brunswick stew, and then, of course, is different as well. And then, of course, as you get on up into central Tennessee, Brunswick stew gets pretty lean on the ground altogether. And actually, as you get to Mississippi, it starts getting pretty lean on the ground, and eventually it disappears out that. Well, this map helped crystallize my ideas, and this is what I'm interested in, is trying to look at distributions and helping making the maps help me focus what I'm thinking about and trying to see patterns. And so that's what we're going to be talking about. One of the things that we know from the very outset, of course, is that the South is not a single place. In fact, it's so much not a single place, I couldn't even draw one line. I had to break down and draw two lines about where the outer limits of the South are. But the South is obviously doesn't look like that at all. And coming over here, I had some barbecue maps and some other things, and I started took 3 days to drive from Charleston, which considering the way I drive means that I covered a lot of miles. It didn't mean that we drove slow. Going back and forth, and one of the things that really stood out is that there is clearly more than one South. Geographers don't like to use state lines anyway, and they've talked about for generations about creating a grits line. And when I talked to John, I thought there was a grits line map. Well, it turns out that there wasn't. If Jim Dandy had given me some data, I could probably create a grits map, but I had to get on the telephone and run up a big bill. My wife hasn't seen it yet, so we're all right. Called people all over the place. This probably is a pretty fair representation of the outer limits. There's a couple of surprising things on this. out here in New Mexico, you can still get grits. I thought that that was very unlikely, but I was assured by Terry Jordan at the University of Texas, who is a redneck by his own admonition, and one of the great Texas scholars, that yes, the Texas part of New Mexico has grits. They also have biscuits, so they're not all bad. In any event, so we have a beginning of a sense of the South, but we have a problem with this map, and that is that as you get up right around here, as you go on up into Tennessee from here, drive up beyond Corinth and head on up there, grit stops being an automatic, or what I call an automatic. Normally you go into a breakfast place, and in southern Alabama it says two eggs, grits, biscuit, whatever. You go on up into central Tennessee and it says two eggs, hash browns, or biscuit gravy, biscuit or toast. See, God, these guys don't even know what biscuits are. Biscuit or toast, and half of those biscuits are coming from Pillsbury, which I don't have any ownership of, so I don't even get credit for that. All I'm stuck with is the name. And so grits are found all the way to the top of that line, but they start getting a little thin, and they're always on the menu, but they're not really there. And so what we end up seeing is the South looks a little more complex. It looks a little more like that. What we have then is a lower South. We have an upper South. Then we have a couple of places that are obviously a little misguided. The low country of South Carolina, where I live now, I didn't understand that until I moved there. Those people are obviously different. Hoppin' John isn't here to defend himself. But those people are, well, Hoppin' John's a little different too. So anyway, those folks are obviously different. They've had some different forces there. We can talk about that in a few minutes. And then, of course, we all know the Cajun country is different, but anybody who's ever spent any time in New Orleans knows that New Orleans ain't Cajun country. And so we really have to talk about Creole and Cajun, and that there is a difference in. But the point is, so there's actually several Souths. We've mentioned this on and off since the beginning this whole meeting. But we really haven't talked about much about why. The whys are pretty straightforward. There's two ways that ideas get from one place to another. One is somebody carries it, migration routes, and the other one is that the idea itself gets sent without people behind it, and that's what's happening today mostly, and it's called diffusion. So we have migration routes and diffusion. We'll talk about diffusion later. This is migration routes. This is a map that, see if I can get it all on there, that helps allowing us to understand and to give you to make it easier on you, if I can find this sucker. I've gone so far away from the notes now. Here we go. Let's look at this version. And what we can see is that these migration routes have helped create what we end up having as the culture regions. I'm going to go back to the map again a little bit more, because I threw some other things on here. And one of the things that we learn right off is that this whole coast is different for a very good reason. And that is because different people settled there. And anybody who's ever spent any time in Charleston knows very well that Charlestonians don't understand that there is any place besides Charleston. Actually, they probably don't understand there's anything beyond Broad Street. So what we ended up having was a little self-contained world down there. They ate a lot of rice. The African influences are massive. Karen Hess has certainly done that up, as well as Hoppin' John and some others. So we have this area down there. And one of the other reasons that Charleston area is different is because, and I didn't really appreciate it until I moved there, is that Charleston may have been the most international city in the colonies, certainly the most diverse culturally of any of the other cities. The only competitors would be New Orleans and Philadelphia and New York. It is estimated as many as 40% of the settlers at one point were so-called Huguenots, but the Huguenots weren't all from Huguenot. A good many of them were really Jews from that had been escaping the Inquisition in Iberia. So a very large population. I attend a Lutheran church in downtown Charleston, the oldest in the South, founded in 1730, and obviously there were a lot of Germans there because there are three very old German churches in downtown Charleston, Lutheran churches, and they were so upset in the 19th century that one of them was using too much English, so they split. So we're talking about, it's not just the fact that they're the way they are, it's a tremendous number of people. Sullivan's Island is sometimes referred to as the Ellis Island of African Americans. There's so many of the African Americans came in there, and that's another reason that we have a very different kind of a pattern as far as Savannah is concerned. And one of the things that's very often overlooked by non-people interested in that sort of thing, of course, is tremendous number of the Carolinians who were Europeans came with the Africans from the Caribbean. So they came in with Caribbean influences, and so they came in used to eating rice. They came in used to they'd already been stealing the African cuisine, if you would like, for a generation or two, and so they were used to that, and so that just continued when they moved on to the mainland. Coming down the Piedmont, was this massive group of people starting in the tobacco area, and then with cotton they moved on down and came across, and that's formed the southern the lowland South as we know it. And the impact of this is really quite interesting. And let me go to, I needed a bigger table, I can feel it. I got one more. Ah, here we go. Now let's leave that one off for a moment. Let's do this one. Here's a map some of you have seen from time to time. This is Charlie Kovacic's, Chuck Kovacic and John Winberry's map of a barbecue region, a barbecue sauce regions in South Carolina, and Charlie's kind of an irreverent sort of fella. He's also from Michigan, and a little brash as a result. And so they wrote a textbook on South Carolina, and they decided they were going to prove you could do a region of anything, and so they sort of faked together this map, which everyone else has taken as gospel. It's not quite gospel, but it's close enough for government work. Well, here we go. If you put the regions on that map, what you see is there really is a reason for that. You have the pepper sauces coming down out of the eastern North Carolina group. You have a Lexington style coming down across the top. You have this question. Here's my geographer working again. I like these question marks. There's a question about where in the ever-loving this ketchup stuff came from. But it starts appearing there for the first time, and that's where you start looking to find out the answer. Then you have the mustard that's up that central area. My pastor insists it's the Germans, being a good Lutheran pastor. What else can he say? And their love of mustard. I don't know, but in any event, what we see is this kind of Charleston-Columbia connection, which is not necessarily obvious because now Columbia is the center of that, but it wasn't always. And we can see this. Another thing that's interesting, of course, is that all of us have been eating barbecue last night, if nowhere else. And one of the lines on this map that we tend to overlook, and this one will work, is this little guy right here. And if you think I'm just going flying by my way just on the basis of slaw, kind of a vinegary tomato barbecue sauce, and the way they cooked the meat, actually the people who developed that line were the linguists. And they were looking at lingual history, and they demonstrated that North Carolina terms came all the way across Tennessee, and having just driven across that 2 days ago, they also brought their folk housing with them, their folk out structures with them, and according to Sam Hilliard, their love of tomatoes for breakfast, in season, of course, which they're not being served right now. In any event, so we have that line coming across there, and that's one of the reasons when you go on up to Tennessee, the barbecue is different than it is down here, is they're getting that feed out of North Carolina. And then finally we have the Upland South. The Upland South, we like to say, is different because of environmentalism. That's easy. It's really different because of the source of the settlers, and the settlers were coming out of Pennsylvania. I ate at Stroud's barbecue the other night. Obviously there was a Pennsylvania Dutchman in there somewhere. These Pennsylvania Germans and Scots, Irish, and whatever came down the mountains. They had additions, of course, all the way. But they created something up there that was very different. And the diet up there is very different. It's only marginally different. You can still get grits, but it's not an automatic. You can still get biscuits, but it's more likely to be from Pillsbury. You can... White Lily notwithstanding. And you can, you know, it's clearly Southern, but it's not the same as Southern Alabama. It's not the same as South Georgia. It's a very different kind of place. So the Southern cuisine has been moving on from the very beginning. It's always been a dynamic sort of a force. Where's my water when I need it? Has been moving out very long. And in fact, one of the other areas that's interesting is this Texas area. You notice the influence coming out of... John, you look like you're... My time is running. It's 10:50. We have the... I respond to this. You know how I tell when the end of class is when they start walking out. we see the Upland South moving in across Arkansas and down in, and then the Lowland South coming up like this. And I always thought they sort of ended out here with those Germans of the Edwards Plateau. But if you're going out here, you still get grits, and most importantly, you still get biscuits. One of the problems with defining the South is that there is no food which is characteristic of the entire South. I thought that you could get biscuits everywhere. You cannot get biscuits everywhere. There's not anybody. Well, Natalie's moved. There's not anybody other than Natalie and six other chefs who know how to make a biscuit in Charleston. You certainly can't go to a restaurant and get one made. We have a place that we like to go to breakfast in Charleston to get biscuits, and they bring them in a bag, heat them up, and give them to you. Now, this is a bakery. But they still don't make their own biscuits. They do that. There's a place over by where Natalie lives, the Sea Biscuit, which they claim to have the best biscuits around. I on my worst day, I can do better than that. They don't. You know, there's a new place. I hope there's nobody from New York Times here. There's a new place called Hominy Grill downtown, and the New York Times in a food review said these are the best biscuits in the South. Give me a break. And if you go out into the rural areas, you almost never get biscuits. You're going to get cornbread, or you're going to get something else, or more likely toast. But the point is biscuits are not a part of that lowland culture. So biscuits are not certainly everywhere. Grits are certainly not everywhere. It was argued at dinner the other night that cornbread, well, but you have to be kind of open-minded about what you're going to call cornbread, whether it has sugar in it, that's probably the biggest thing, or white cornmeal, that's something that's critical to some of us. And there basically isn't anything. The South is more a place because the outsiders said we were different than because we were anything like each other. When I first went to LSU back in the 60s, they had to assign me an interpreter the first week. But You know, after you'd been there for a while, you could tell somebody from South Louisiana, well, that wasn't hard, that's a piece of cake. You could tell somebody from Terrebonne Parish in a heartbeat from somebody from Natchitoches, but you could also tell somebody from Poplar, Mississippi, from either one of those places, and you could tell somebody from Alabama. And those accents are disappearing today, but the South has always been a very distinct place and has had tremendous amount of regional differentiation. And that, of course, is one of the real problems that we're facing today, is not only that is there a nationalization going on, but also the regional patterns are disappearing, because what's happening is that, and don't take this personally, Natalie, someone gets on television and says, this is the way to make biscuits. And she raised that question yesterday and said, of course, there's not some way to make biscuits. But we have the Southern Living and the Food Channel and everybody else standing around saying, there's a biscuit, there's a gumbo, we're going to have gumbo, dueling gumbos for lunch. There's a this, there's an a that, and there's not, and there never was. To give an idea that some of these things still exist, Carolina does not do Brunswick stew. They do what they call hash. It has nothing to do with that corned beef and potato stuff that my mother used to make when I was growing up. There are three hashes, and as best as I can tell after filming them, Stan and I are working on a film on Carolina hash as a part of the larger Southern Stews project. And as best as I can tell, those three hashes are not related in any way to each other than the name. And I notice we're having duck hash somewhere down the food line on this thing. The oldest hash, well, let's go to beef hash first. Beef hash may or may not be the oldest hash. The recipe for beef hash is really quite simple. You take beef. We filmed one, and we were going to try to have a film to show it to you, but Stan couldn't get it together. Well, he's working very hard. In any event, we went up and filmed one a while back, and of course, we're only filming the black pot stuff and all that. But the basic recipe was 400 pounds of beef, about 100 pounds of really fatback. They called it pork, but it was really fatback to give it a little flavor. And they cooked that for about 8-10 hours, drained all the liquid off. We pulled everything out that wasn't something that you really wanted to think about eating. they poured in a 50-pound bag of onions and cooked it another 8 hours, and served it up. Very thick stuff. Well, if you stop and think about that, that's Mr. Matthews' Brunswick stew, except it's using beef instead of squirrels. Squirrels are a little light on the land right now. And so we got interviewing these guys, and they said, well, our favorite stew is actually wild rabbit hash. The guy had 24 beagles in the backyard that he used to catch wild rabbits with. And he said, of course, he said that was the Cadillac, but the Rolls Royce was Cooter, which is turtles. But the point is that in essence, there is this original meat stew, which is clearly European in origin. Well, not origin, but it came to us from Europe. And so we have that, and we see that diffusion line. It's not coming down from Virginia. For some reason, South Carolina, that's probably in their education system, didn't adopt the more modern vegetable-prone stuff, and they kept the original hash name and did their thing. The maybe the oldest is the liver hash. Now, liver hash is a very watery, somewhere between gravy it's a very watery gravy, basically. Kid needs anything else that's inside there, you don't know quite what else to do with. Usually a pig's head. Cook it all up, and you put it over rice. Jessica, not here, is she? She was working, thinking about that for a recipe. It probably is African, I would guess. It could be European, but it's probably African. And it's interesting, it's only found in the rice-eating areas. How amazing. And again, I never made that connection until I sat down and started fiddling with this map. Adobe Illustrator is so fun. You can do things that you never thought of doing otherwise. And then finally, we have the most, the largest of the hashes and the growing one. That's the most modern one. It's pork. When I first went to South Carolina and was going to the barbecue places, I can't stand over there, barbecue places, I just thought it was badly made Brunswick stew. It looks a lot like Brunswick stew. It doesn't have the vegetables in it. It's mostly found in barbecue places, and I think it really is a Brunswick stew replacement. And it's kind of zooming on up into where modernization is most obvious. The further you go back into the woods, you're either going to go into a liver hash or a beef hash. And if you go to where there's more outlanders, then you're going to go into the pork hash. Which is still trying to be local, but isn't really. It's been modernized from God knows where. So these regionalizations still exist to a certain extent, but they are obviously also disappearing. One of the problems with doing research in this kind of work is the fact that things are more like they used to be now than what they were before. I remember when I was at LSU, what they used to like to do with us at LSU was take us out in the middle of nowhere, drop us off and give us an assignment to do. And that's how we learned to do field work. They didn't tell you anything. They just dropped you off and sink or swim. And this was 1962. This was not a good time to be a Yankee wandering around Mississippi. without any idea that these guys were going to believe. But anyway, it was exciting. We spent a lot of time down in the Cajun country as well. And one of the things I noticed when I went back 20 years later was that there were more Cajuns now than there used to be. There was more etouffee. There was this blackened stuff that I'd never seen when I was there the first time. And the whole recipe was more authentic than it was when you go into some of these places and they didn't speak English. Now everybody spoke English and they were more authentic. This is a very real problem in trying to define what's going on trying to find the past. But we can see where change is taking place. Got one more map here. Oh, yes, there it is. This is the New South. And what we're trying to suggest with this is that, yes, there is still the remnants of the Old South. And if you go to Ripley, Tennessee, or you go to Homerville, Georgia, or you go to Buffalo, South Carolina, yes, you can find the real South. You went to Buffalo.
I did.
You go to Midway?
I did.
Got some good liver hash. They got it right out there in the counter. You, they don't have that at Kroger. Anyway. And see, I read your book. You didn't think I did. But if you go into cities, if you go to Atlanta, we used to have people fly into Atlanta and they'd want to see Southern food. And I'd say, well, you got 2 hours so we can drive out beyond the edge of the urban field. Actually, you can't get to the edge of the urban field in 2 hours anymore. But, so in essence, what's happening, of course, is places there where there's growth, you have outlanders, and that traditional food disappears except somebody's interpretation of that, usually garnered from reading Natalie's books or The Southern Living. Well, Southern Living, according to her, sells more books, so they must have more impact. And so that's what you're more likely to see. Even Mary Max is not Mary Max anymore. Well, it's still got the name, but it's not the same place anymore. And what little, and the colonnade, and, all, and there is no Southern food left in Atlanta. If you go into some of the
colonnade hasn't changed one iota.
It hasn't changed one. Yeah, but they're coming all in walkers now, right?
You can still find Southern food in Atlanta. It just gets tougher to dig down and find that layer of the earth.
Yeah, well, I was working there. If you go into poor neighborhoods and into the black neighborhoods and some of the other places, you can find it. But it's getting harder and harder. You're more likely to go to folks, which I don't even want to go another word with that. But the point is that change is taking place in the urban areas. Nobody is still moving to Union and Buffalo. Nobody in their, some people in their right mind would move to Buffalo. Some people in their right mind would move to Folly Beach, but most people wouldn't. And so, in essence, what we're doing is when we talk about these regions, we have to understand that there's vast areas of change, and those changes are concentrated in the urban areas. What I didn't show the change taking place on this map because it would make it too messy. Did you have to sit outside? There was the first woman geographer had to sit outside the lecture hall, so we're very sensitive about that. Gender discrimination is not new, but it's still alive and well. If you go up to anywhere, one of the things that blew my mind this week is when I was wandering around the middle of nowhere, in Tennessee, there was Mexican restaurants. Of course, the Hispanic flood is roaring in and coming in. And so, and they're making an impact, not just in the large cities. They're making an impact anywhere. There's a chicken processing plant. There's some work that the resident population is not willing to do. And they're everywhere. And ultimately, they're going to change the entire food system. My wife used to sell textbooks in Georgia, public school textbooks, and she was up in Cedartown, which is pretty close to the middle of nowhere. And she was doing one of her dog and pony shows and mentioned that they had Spanish and some other languages, your basic math books. And somebody raised their hand and says, "Do you have Cantonese?" So here in rural Georgia, enough Cantonese had come in to work at a carpet factory that they needed Cantonese math books. And as it so happened, Addison Wesley had it. So she said, "Sure, we do." The point is that this is making a tremendous change. The two centers of change, or actually three centers of change, one are these migrants coming in from south of the border and other immigrants that are coming into the United States in large numbers. The second one is those coming in for growth. And we had a conversation at breakfast about how Charlotte is changing with the banks. As Hugh McCall did a fast one on Bank of America and ended up with all the cookies, and all the rest of the things are going on. We have outlanders coming. Atlanta is the ultimate outlander center in the region, but there are elsewhere. And then finally, we have the retirees that are coming in certain areas. So up here in the Asheville Hendersonville area. It is a massive change. Where I'm living on the Carolina coast, all of my neighbors are from somewhere else. And I live on the Redneck Island. But if we went to the next island south, the Kiowa, I don't think they speak Southern on Kiowa. The point is that we have a tremendous number of outsiders coming in, and they are making a change, and they are not no longer cornered just in Florida. They're moving to all kinds of places, through the mountains of North Georgia, through the mountains of North Carolina, on the coast. And their next stop is going to places like Buffalo, because you can go to Buffalo, well, not Buffalo, but you can go to St. George, South Carolina for $50,000. You can pick up 100-year-old house. You can spend some time fixing it up, and you can live right well on less money than you were living before. Well, you And the same thing, of course, is happening in Iowa as well, except nobody wants to put up with the winters. But you can go up into the little towns in Iowa, and you can buy a real house for $40,000, $50,000. Not a trailer, a real house. Probably with some age on it, and you're into old things, and you just have a good time. So this whole push has been taking place, and I just remembered we had one other place to go before I quit. There is no map of the diaspora of Southerners. So a surrogate measure is African Americans. The Census Bureau does not recognize rednecks, we can't use that. What we see, of course, is that the big push for African Americans, and actually the big push for all Southerners, has been in the 20th century. Something like 95% of all African Americans lived in the Old South as late as 1910. And this push has been relatively recent, and we can see that the centers are what we expect. New York doesn't have as big a dot as it ought to, but you can see it has 3.4 million. That's because there's too many areas. Washington, New York, Chicago, Detroit, Los Angeles. And what's more important is that if you take to the next step, I know we got another map here. Don't worry about them. That's one way I don't have to look at them again. There we go. Because that's the last map. If we look, we realize that the Southerners didn't go at random. If you lived in South Carolina, you were unlikely to go to Chicago. That doesn't mean that some guy didn't go to Chicago. That means that you were unlikely to go to Chicago. You were unlikely to go to St. Louis. You were likely to go to Washington, Philadelphia, or New York. If you lived in the Mississippi Delta, you would go up the river. We all know jazz told us that. To Chicago, to St. Louis, to Kansas City, to Detroit. And so therefore, if you want your Delta ribs, you don't go to New York, you go to Chicago. And Lois has, you had a wonderful piece about that in your Smokestack Lightning. Just loved it. And so when we talk about this movement of the South, food moving out, there are real patterns there. That is to say that this Mississippi area is moving for the most part on up into the Midwestern cities. This is moving up here, and then the upland South moved into Detroit and Cleveland and Pittsburgh in those areas. When I was teaching at West Virginia, one of my less delightful experiences in life, one of the things that was, I loved West Virginia, I just couldn't cope with Morgantown. One of the experiences that we ran into every Friday night and every Sunday night was a stream of cars coming from Pittsburgh and Cleveland. On Friday night, they were going home. And on Sunday night, they were going back to work. And this is the kind of movement that we used to see. Today, that's not happening because their children say, what do you mean go home to Kentucky? Home is in Detroit. There is that counter movement. With migration, for every stream, there is a counter stream. And so one of the big changes that we're seeing today is so many Southerners coming back saying, Chicago is cold. I don't need to live up here. And so they're coming back, but they don't go back to Buffalo, South Carolina or Homerville. They're going back to Atlanta and Charlotte and those places. And so even they are bringing back what they're bringing. One of the upshots of this, however, is that the Southern food that you find in Chicago is more like it was 30 years ago than what they find here in the South. It's like the speakers out on the Eastern Shore who speak old Elizabethan English because they never changed. And so you take what you remember. I remember where I came from as it was when I left, not the tacky place that it has become since then, which is the reason I didn't move it back there. So what's happening then, and it may well be that you can get the best Southern food, not in Oxford, Mississippi, but from Glory Foods in Columbus, Ohio, and Georgia Browns and whatever. Except he is really a carpetbagger. So anyway, by his own admission, so am I, so don't take it personally. So in any event, do we have any questions, queries, thoughts? Yes, Natalie, I've taken so much exception. Let's.
Yes. Oral history that I've done this year is from a white woman who grew up not too far from here. She was a relative of the Holworths, like a second cousin. We'll get that straight later. But she moved from Tennessee, from the Memphis area, down to Savannah when she became president of the Junior League. So she was a woman of a certain class. And so I asked her about learning of Southern cooking and the African-American influence within that. And it's given me something, a different aspect of it, which is that she said, and I think when you did your map coming up from Charleston, who came from Charleston where, it gave me this other handle, and it's something that I don't think I've read anywhere, which is she said that when she grew up in Tennessee, a white woman had to become master of the kitchen and had to know what she was doing because the African-Americans there were not the ones from Charleston who knew how to cook in Savannah. But she said when she went to Savannah that there, I asked her, I think, who taught who how to cook? She's in her 80s. And she said, so when she was in Tennessee, the white women were the instructors. Then when she went to Charleston and meets Savannah, the African-Americans were so much, she said, they were so much smarter than we were and so much better learned in skills that she said they taught us everything that we needed to know. So then I got into biscuits, and this is what's going on. It seems to me then that the biscuit must have been an English thing that landed in the center of Tennessee, Kentucky, those kinds of regions, and then spread out from the Midwest and became part of the Anglophile flour system that started there and came out. So what I'm hoping to do is to do a flour map, which I think might start in the middle and come down. And that's why I think, and I agree with you, that they don't have the biscuits in Charleston.
Well, I forgot you were a flack for White Lily, but... Relax, Natalie. Now, in all seriousness, one of the other things that we need to keep in mind about biscuits is that the rural Southerner until the 20th century couldn't afford white flour. So they were not going to be, biscuits were not common among the mass of Southerners until pretty much the price of flour went down. And of course, if you'll buy my book, there's a chart of the changing cost of flour in there. And it drops by 500% in the 19th century with the arrival of railroad. And one of the negative aspects that we talked about yesterday... Yes, it is a socioeconomic question. And one of the issues that we talked about yesterday with White Lily and whatever was, of course, what we brought in initially was that tacky Pillsbury General Mills. They're now the same people. But and there's nothing, that's the only thing I use up for some reason. But the point being is that that's not proper to make biscuits, which is why my biscuits are like hockey pucks rather than like your biscuits. I agree. Yes, sir.
When the food traveled to Chicago, to Cleveland, to Pittsburgh, didn't it change then as well? Because there just weren't, you couldn't go pop scroll out of a tree when you there are a lot of things you
could get. By the 20th century, nobody was using squirrel except for cookbook people on
hunting caps.
That we're not talking about. The South ate more game than any other region longer, and I'm not denying that. Don't get me wrong. But if you're living in downtown New Orleans, you're not going to go squirrel hunting either, or Memphis or whatever. So I think that's a bit of a red herring in the larger issue of the whether squirrels are. But yes, it changed, and it changes every time you get married. I married a woman of Italian ancestry, and I discovered that we could not get through a week without pasta. Well, as we pointed out the other day, pasta is not macaroni and cheese. At least to her, it's not. And you shouldn't barbecue it. And so, yes, my diet changed. It changed every time you marry. It changes every time you that you move. There is a certain bit of that. But part of what we're dealing with these, and this is why Mr. Lee can sell a boiled peanuts for $100 to that poor guy in Alaska, is the guy is not really buying peanuts. He's buying nostalgia. He's buying memories. And so there is really two tracks. There's what you're putting on your table, and then there's what you eat at special times when you want to be nostalgic or that kind of thing. You've had your hand up for so long.
Alex, do you have any map that demonstrates the great gravy divide?
Well, if I ever get a publisher for this book and I get it finished, I'll give you one. Right now, no. I probably shouldn't go looking for a publisher calling it, having a disparaging comment about Southern Living, though. Jim!
How do you see the Mexican and Latino influence changing Southern food? I mean, what do you, like, the years out, what do you think it's really going to affect the core of what we hear when we consider Southern food?
Please repeat the question.
Jim's asking what I think the overall impact of Hispanic cuisine is going to be on traditional Southern cuisine. It's going to be like pizza, in a sense, in that it's starting going to be integrated into the weekly meal pattern. Southerners already ate pretty hot stuff. In other areas, we're seeing an up push in the amount of Texas Pete and whatever, and you can buy jalapeno peppers in almost every grocery store in America now. I think that we're also going to see a lot more tortillas and that sort of thing slide into the menu, so that you start with a wrap instead of a piece of bread and work out from that. And the place to see that most importantly is in like California. I would argue, I did argue in No Foreign Food, that California cuisine, which started out as basically Midwestern cuisine, has been so in what we think of as California cuisine is really this marrying, this creolization, to go back to last year's theme, this creolization of Asian and Hispanic and these other trends to create things. The whole half-cooked California approach to vegetables really is coming in from that Asian. What are you laughing at? You came from Kentucky. You know that they don't really cook their vegetables.
Reconstated is that barbecue wrap. Good barbecue with coleslaw wrapped in a tortilla.
Really?
Great.
So I think that's what we're going to really probably see, Jim, is you know, an integration of the individual items, especially as we start getting some quality tortillas and some of the other important things. Yes, sir.
Richard, would you comment on Southern Florida from about the Gainesville South? I know it's on all your maps.
Well, that's not part of the South.
Strategically, it is because it was
It's only because it's south of what's north of it. Essentially, South Florida was unsettled until Flagler built the railroad. And the people who settled there after the railroad were mostly Yankees. Now they have a little more southern flair to them, south of Florida altogether. And, of course, a large Canadian contingent in South Florida as well. But the old traditional southern life ended. So they generally draw the line somewhere between Gainesville and Ocala, and that's about where the South ended. And, of course, once Disney moved into Orlando, if there was ever any hope for Florida, it died right there on the spot.
and we created the Centennial, and you know, it's just one giant plastic world down there. It's sort of where we're going. I'm glad I'm no younger than I really am. Yes, sir.
My grandparents lived on a farm in southwestern Georgia, and their daily bread was hoe cake.
Right, because they couldn't afford flour. Hoe cake.
Hoe cake.
Right.
Biscuits were commonly. The hoe cake was made from corn that was raised on their place and ground up and cut the roast. The second thing is my son lives in Chicago, and he cannot find white lily flour.
Well, now, the white Philly people told us just the other day, but they can get it from Mr. Lee. Of course, the freight's a little bit much, but they can get it from Mr. Lee, and if they send it from Charleston, it'll be cheaper. I think that if we go back into the past, before the railroads lowered food costs, I think that what you're suggesting, almost everything local, except for company, was pretty common. If you were black, you probably were eating a sweet potato for breakfast and maybe cornbread, and you would dip the cornbread in buttermilk. You know, when I first came to the South, we were talking about meat and three yesterday. When I first came to the South, the standard with the meat and three drinks were tea, and we all know what that means. That certainly doesn't mean what I grew up with, a sweet tea, properly made sweet tea, not from some machine, and coffee and buttermilk. Buttermilk was the standard third automatic drink anywhere in the lowland South, and that's all gone. You have my condolences for being from Minnesota. John tells me it's time is out. I can feel it.
It is time. We'll take a thank you, Dick. Thank you.